This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Good evening, this is Jerry Clinton welcoming you again to an episode of Night Transmissions. This is episode 101, if you're keeping count. I do, but that's kind of my job, keeping count. Tonight, we're going to start off with a show from the Crime Club, which was first aired on January the 23rd of 1947. And it's called Mr. Smith's Hat. Like most of the stories in the Crime Club, Mr. Smith's Hat was adapted from a Doubleday Crime Club selection, this time from Helen Riley's 1936 novel of the same name. I have no idea how many people remember Helen Riley. She was born in 1891 and would live until 1962. Growing up in New York City in a very literary family. Her brother, James, also wrote mystery novels. And two of her daughters, Ursula Curtis and Mary Mullen, have also written mysteries. Tonight's episode features Riley's main character, homicide detective Christopher McKee, who was featured in most of her book. Helen Riley is credited with being important in the development of the police procedural style of fiction, which is so common today. Tonight's story, like so many of Riley's stories, focuses on a formerly well-to-do New Yorker who is downwardly mobile, as in the victim in tonight's tale, who abandoned his snooty relatives to live a life of drinking and bohemianism. And it's not all that bad to me.
Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Yes, this is the Crime Club. I'm the librarian. Mr. Smith's Hat. Yes, we have that Crime Club story for you. Come right over. Good. Take the easy chair by the window. Comfortable? The book is on this shelf. Here it is. Mr. Smith's Hat by Helen Riley. A very intriguing story of a finger that puts its print on death. Let's look at it under the reading lamp. It was a bad day for New York City. The worst in a 3-week period of early summer heat. And Inspector Christopher McKee was in his office at the Center Street Police Headquarters when the telephone rang.
Yes, Inspector McKee talking, homicide?
Yes, I was just going to talk to you about that.
What?
Homicide. How'd you like to meet a freshly made corpse?
Go ahead, mister.
Well, go to 1142 West 16th Street, Gilbert Shannon's apartment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not there now, but don't worry. You'll find me waiting for you.
What's your name?
Gilbert Shannon.
Well, I'll be of all the days to be hung up by a lunatic.
Yes, Inspector McKee.
Cassidy, get the local precinct for West 16th Street. I want them to check on a nut.
Yes, sir.
Hold a minute. Inspector McKee, homicide.
Inspector. Inspector, my father's been killed. Murdered.
Mm-hmm. All right, lady, give me the facts. Name, please.
Gilbert Shannon, 1142 West 16th what? Street.
What's that?
1142 West 16th Street. I just found him lying on the floor in a pool of blood.
Your name, please.
Julie. Will you please send someone over here right away, please? Please?
Yes. Cassidy.
Yes, Inspector.
Never mind calling the local precinct. Get the medical examiner and order my car. I'm going up to that place myself.
I walked in, Inspector. Dad never bothered to lock the door. He didn't believe he had anything worth stealing, except a lot of unpaid bills.
And empty whiskey bottles, Miss Shannon, all over the place.
We pleaded with him to give up this dingy apartment. Oliver and I begged him.
Who's Oliver?
My uncle, Inspector. Oliver Gold.
The utilities man?
Mm-hmm. Since my mother died 2 years ago, I've been living with him and Tams and his wife in their big house on East 54th Street.
Mm.
They wanted Dad to stay there, too, but he was stubborn.
Why?
He didn't want charity. He wouldn't let anyone help him. Not even Sandus DeMora, his oldest friend. Not even me, his own daughter.
I seem to have enough money for liquor, Miss Shannon.
That wasn't very often. You see, Dad was a writer. Popular magazine stories. Sometimes he sold one. Then he...
Yeah, I know. Must have been pretty tough on you and your mother. Well, let's see what happened here. Gilbert Shannon was sitting at that desk, working, his back to the door, when someone came in and cracked him on the skull with a blunt instrument. Not once, but six times.
Please, Inspector.
I'm sorry. It was a vicious crime done by a vicious person. Someone who feared or hated your father.
But I don't know of anyone.
It was also someone your father trusted and was expecting.
What?
The blows were all on the back of the head. In other words, when Gilbert Shannon's killer opened that door, your father knew who it was. He didn't turn around, but kept right on working.
Inspector McKee, do you realize what you're saying?
I always do, Miss Shannon.
But it's crazy. Why, Dad's friends were the best in the world. They were always trying to do things for him. I can't think of
one... Know thine enemies, but beware of thy friends. A wise old saying, young lady. And in some cases of murder, I've known it to apply to relatives, too. Let's go.
Where are you taking me?
Home. I'd like to meet Oliver and Tamsin Galt and Santos DeMora and maybe a man who commits murder and then likes to play ghost.
Julie, I think you ought to go upstairs and lie down.
I don't feel like it, Tamsin.
She is so right, Julie, my dear. It is no good for you to hear all this talk about murder.
Please, Santos.
Like Gilbert, she is so obstinate.
Inspector McKee, you haven't answered my question.
Your question, Mr. Galt?
About the newspapers.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. What do you want me to do?
Keep this matter private.
Why?
My position, of course. I'm vice president of Eastern Utilities. I don't want a scandal.
Oh, what are you afraid of?
Gilbert Shannon was my brother-in-law. He was married to my sister.
You haven't answered my question, Mr. Galt.
I don't want his private life made public. It wasn't clean.
Oliver.
Well, Julie, let's face it. We've been ashamed of him for a long time, long before your mother died. Now, why should I be punished for his mistakes?
He never did anything to hurt you. He wouldn't even take your pity.
Now, there, Julie. Oliver didn't mean what he said.
Well, Inspector?
I make no promises. As an old-time citizen, I think it's bad business to interfere with the press.
But my reputation...
We'll worry about that later. Where were you this afternoon?
At my office.
Every minute?
Until 12:15. Then I had lunch, and after that... Now, look here, Inspector...
After lunch, Mr. Galt?
I went for a walk.
A long walk?
I was back at my office at 2:15.
Mm-hmm. Shannon was killed between 12:30 and 2.
Inspector McKee, if you're intimating that
How about you, Mrs. Galt? Where were you?
On Fifth Avenue, shopping.
Buy anything?
No.
Meet anyone?
No. Inspector, I thought you said the murderer was a man.
Oh, did I? Never take a policeman literally, Miss Shannon, until he waves a pair of handcuffs. Now, Mr. DeMora.
I was in Central Park all afternoon. For work, it was too hot, the weather.
You meet anyone?
Only the pigeons and the squirrels, Inspector.
Yes, and they can't talk.
Senor, it is quite useless to make up a case about us. Not one person in this room had a reason or a wish to dispose of Gilbert. You will prove nothing to the contrary.
Nice going. Certainly stick together. I hope you don't have to hang together.
Hello. One moment, please.
For you, Inspector.
Oh, thank you. Yes? Yes, Cassidy. Hmm? Where? Okay, put it through the lab. Oh? Good work. Have a check for type. Yes, I'll tell them. Bye. Well. Everything comes to him who waits.
What is it, Inspector?
A few things to worry about, Mrs. Galt. The murder weapon has been found. Would one of you like to guess?
I'm sick of this, Inspector. You have no right to make us all feel like...
All right. It was a hammer. The postman took it out of a mailbox on Lower Fifth Avenue.
What?
Tamsin?
Don't look at me. I didn't go below 50th Street.
But it is quite ridiculous. If one desired to conceal or dispose
Haste
of a weapon...
Haste makes many mistakes. Now, Miss Shannon.
Are you going to waive the handcuffs, Inspector?
When you entered your father's apartment, did you go out again before I arrived?
No.
Well, somebody did. There was a fresh smear of lipstick on the inside doorknob. She'd make a wonderful fingerprint. Huh? No comments? All right. Miss Shannon, the district attorney has released your father's body for burial. You can make the arrangements.
Thank you. It's so awfully kind of you.
I've been in touch with all of you, and don't try to leave town unless you're so hot you'd like to spend some time in the cooler. Well, Cassidy?
The funeral services should be starting any minute, sir.
Are they all here?
They are, Inspector, they are. In that first pew, Mr. Santos de Borda with Mr. Oliver Galt sitting next to him. Then it's Mrs. Galt and Julie Shannon.
Notice anything?
It's heathen they are, Inspector McKee. The way they're rushing that poor fellow's body off the face of the earth.
Yes, I thought of that.
And he's not dead more than a few hours. It ain't decent. That's what comes of having daylight saving time. If the time was normal, now...
Who's that fellow sitting over there in the last pew with his hat on?
Who, sir?
Yeah.
Another heathen. To be wearing a hat in the Lord's house. A hat that's so loud, it's loud enough for the racetrack and shabby enough for a funeral of its own. I told him to take it off.
Wait a minute. He seems to be sobbing.
Why, so he does. And all the time I've been taking him from an old, no-good vagrant. Inspector, do you think he might be...
Right. Getting out. Coming this way.
And sure I'll be the devil's own witness. He ain't sobbing. He's laughing. And in a church. And at a funeral, too. Now, see here,
let
you.
Let
me
handle him, Cassidy. What's the idea?
Damon and Pythias, the spider on the fly. Who is less noble than man?
You tell me.
Nothing, and no one. In the beginning, there were serpents and vermin, and today, they walk like men. Excuse me, I have an appointment with a nightmare.
Oh, it's crazy with the heat the poor fellow is. You should have let him go, Inspector. He might be dangerous.
Get after him, Cassidy.
Oh, sure.
Keep a tail on him. I want to know who he is and where he lives.
But we could have asked him, sir, when he was sitting
there. That's not all I want to know, Your Honor. Now get going and report to me at my office. I'll be there all evening. Inspector McKee talking homicide.
Cassidy talking, sir.
What'd you get?
Well, sir, I tailed that fellow to a broken-down tenement house on 10th Avenue.
Hmm?
He's got a room on the third floor.
Good. What about his name?
Believe it or not, Inspector, it's John Smith.
It's happened before. What else, Cassidy?
Well, sir, Smith stayed indoors for about an hour and a half, and when he emerged, it was only to lock himself up in a phone booth in the corner drugstore.
Did you find out whom he called?
I couldn't, sir, but I know he made two calls, Inspector.
Yes?
It was on the second one that I was able to catch a few words.
What were they, Cassidy?
Well, sir, there must have been an argument, because all of a sudden Smith's voice went up, and he said, "You'll be there in half an hour, and don't keep me waiting." And that's all.
Is it? Did Mr. Smith go to sleep in that booth?
Oh, no, sir. He came out and walked straight uptown to Central Park. And that, Inspector, is where it happened.
What? What happened?
Well, sir, he was walking along a path near the 59th Street Lake with me about 50 feet behind him.
Yes.
Something was wrong with the park lights, because a whole row of them was out. And then...
Mm-hmm. No, go on, Cassidy.
Well, sir, it was pretty dark, but I could see that hat. It shone like a beacon light on a dark and empty ocean.
Never mind the poetry. Give me the facts to the point.
Yes, sir. Well, just before he turned off the path onto another one, he took off his hat.
Yes, yes.
Inspector McKee, I've been a member of the force for 32 years. I can retire and take my pension and live the good life of a peaceful man, but I haven't done it. Instead, I have chosen to stay in the service of the department and devote myself entirely.
Oh, no, you lost him.
I couldn't help it, sir. He took off his hat.
But
if the park department had fixed those lights at the proper time...
He was going to meet somebody and you lost him.
I'm sorry, Inspector. I'm a broken-hearted man.
We could have broken this case tonight. Close the books on it. Oh, well, have you had something to eat?
No, sir.
We'll get something and then come back here to my office. We'll have a good cry together.
Hello, Thompson.
Oh, Sanders, what are you doing here?
I came in for a lonely drink. I saw you sitting at this table. I am delighted.
Oliver took Julie and me home after the funeral, and he went out to keep an appointment. Julie went to bed.
I am glad the dessert is good, Thompson, darling. It gives me an opportunity.
Sanders, please.
But I am only holding your hand. Is it forbidden?
Yes. We never know who might be looking.
Well, let them look. Do I care?
Well, I do.
Thompson.
Stop making a fool of yourself and leave me alone.
It has not always been like this.
It is now. I'm not ready to lose, Oliver.
Lose? You do not lose something you do not want.
That's how I feel about you, Sanders.
I do not like to hear such talk. Yesterday it was different. You could not stand to live with Oliver.
I've changed my mind. And if you were a good sport...
No, I am not a good sport when there is no good reason.
Why didn't you tell me that you haven't got a penny to your name?
Is it important?
But shouldn't it be? Would you have me divorce Oliver for a marriage without money? At your age?
I see. You would rather be with a man you do not love.
He isn't impossible, Sanders.
A fish.
With gold fins.
When did you find this out about me?
Last night at dinner. Oliver mentioned that your business was on the rocks and that you were going into bankruptcy.
And immediately love flew out the window.
I like my daily bread. And butter.
You cannot do this to me when I have lost everything. It's unbearable.
Oh, stop it, Casanova. Don't you know when you're licked?
Julie.
Why, Santos, I'm surprised at you. The lady wants to be with her husband, and you keep...
What are you doing in this place, Julie? I thought you were home in bed.
Did my father know about you, too?
Gilbert?
Don't answer that. I think he did. And he was killed for knowing too much. Am I right, Tamsin?
You're completely out of your mind.
You were afraid that Dad might tell Oliver about you and Santos. That would have cost you a good home plus a lot of money.
Julie, you're not making sense. Tamsin could not kill
him. Stop being so loyal, Romeo. She just tore the balcony down.
Oh, I'm going home.
A good place for you, Tamsin. Maybe you can find the hammer that used to be in that second floor closet.
What?
I looked for it tonight. It wasn't there.
You might ask one of the servants about that.
Shall I ask one of the servants about my lipstick, too?
Look here, Julie. I've had enough of your nasty little insinuations. If anyone had a motive for killing your father, you did. He made your life miserable, and he destroyed your mother. He killed her.
Tamsin?
You know how she died. She didn't fall in front of that subway train. She threw herself.
No. No.
And the next time you feel like accusing someone of murder, think of the consequences. All of them. Good night.
It is true, unfortunately, Julie. Gilbert was my oldest friend, but sometimes even I did not understand it. Come, I will take you home to Oliver's house.
Yes. Yes, two reservations on the midnight plane. Splendid. Mrs. Galton, I'll pick them up at 11:45. Thank you.
Really?
Tamsin, I didn't hear you come in.
Where are we going on such short notice?
Mexico.
Why?
The newspapers have got hold of Gilbert's case. By tomorrow morning, all the filth in that man's life will become public gossip, and I don't want to face it.
Of course. But why must we go tonight?
Because I decided. Now, let's pack. We've very little time.
I can't go, Oliver.
What? Now, look here, Tamsin.
Now, please listen to me. I can't leave Julie. She needs me.
Oh, she'll get along.
You don't know how she carried on tonight after you went out. It wouldn't be fair to desert her at a time like this.
But I... Oh, well... All right, I'll phone the airport for another reservation.
No, Oliver. Julie needs time to organize herself. She's had a terrible shock. Why don't you go alone, and we'll join you in a few days?
Well...
You won't have to face the publicity, and I'll have a chance to help Julie.
Yes, very well. I can wait for you at the Continental Hotel in Mexico City, and from there we can go on to... That's a good idea, Tamsin. Will you phone the airport and cancel your reservation while I go upstairs and pack?
Of course, darling. Hello? Police headquarters? Inspector McKee, please. Inspector McKee? This is Tamsin Galt. I came home a few minutes ago and I found that my husband has disappeared. Yes. Two of his suitcases are gone. Well, I phoned the airport... And I was told that he'd made a reservation on the midnight plane for him and me. Well, I don't know why he included me, but... No, I didn't cancel it. I didn't want Oliver to become suspicious. Yes. You're quite welcome. Goodbye.
Tamsin, you just made a serious blunder.
Oliver.
You should have called the airport first. Now Inspector McKee will know that you were lying.
Oliver, put down that candlestick.
It was all worked out in your precious little mind, wasn't it? Julie needed care, loving care.
I didn't mean it, Oliver. I'll call the inspector. I'll tell him...
It's too late, Tamsin. Would you like to know how much I really loved you?
Oliver, please give me a chance.
As much as I hate you now.
You won't kill me. Somebody's listening on this phone now. Oliver, no.
Yes, Tamsin.
No. Yes.
Hello? Hello?
Ah, I'm
tired, Cassidy. It's been a long day.
Sure, but wouldn't you be feeling good enough now to eat that sandwich I birch for your good appetite?
Oliver Galt, big utilities man, making a getaway. Every day, a new surprise.
What's he be getting when he finds the airport loaded down with cops?
Mm. Yes? Mm-hmm. You don't say. Are you sure? You gotta be sure. Okay.
What's the trouble, sir, if you don't mind me asking?
Those fingerprints we found on the doorknob of Shannon's apartment, Cassidy.
They ain't good.
They belong to a John Ravillo.
I don't recall no such name, sir.
The San Diego confidence man arrested 21 years ago, broke jail 6 months later, was never found.
Well, well, that sort of changes the picture, don't it? Ravillo. Could that be a Spanish name?
I don't know.
On the other hand, it's possible that a fellow who calls himself John Smith and laughs at the church funeral might...
Yeah, yeah, anything's possible now. Inspector McKee, homicide.
Cassidy. Trace.
Yes, sir.
What's the joke, mister?
We meet again, Inspector, and again it's bad news.
Tell me about it.
You know who this is?
A ghost of Gilbert Shannon.
A toast to the wise. Death begets death. And when it's murder, there can be no end except in death.
What's that?
It's happened again. But now it's a beautiful lady. Young, charming.
Who was it?
Tamsin Galt.
What?
A horror of horrors to be snuffed out in the prime of life.
Now listen, you, if this is a gag,
goodbye, Inspector. I assume your next stop will be the Galt Mansion on East 54th Street, which is now a tomb.
Cassidy. Cassidy.
It was only we, Inspector. That car was made from a booth near the guard house.
Never mind that. Pick up Smith and hold him here until I get back, if I ever do. Let's keep talking to Shannon. I've got work to do.
Well, I didn't know what had happened until you came to the house, Inspector McKee. Santos Tomorrow brought me home, and I went straight up to my room.
Where'd he go?
He left me at the front door, Inspector.
Well, all right. I'm satisfied. I think we'll wrap up this candle holder now. The fingerprints on it should tell us who struck the first blow.
The first?
Yes. Tamsin Galt was not killed by a blow on the head. She was smothered to death.
Good heavens.
By someone who held her nose and mouth while she was unconscious.
But how can you tell?
Those swollen veins in her neck and the color of her face.
How dreadful. But who?
Anybody. It didn't require courage or strength.
I see. What about Oliver?
Huh? Why do you mention him?
He might have found out that Santos and Tamsin were... Well...
Oh, one of those things, huh? Did your father know about them, too?
He must have. The hammer he was killed with was taken out of this house.
Well, thank you. Why didn't you talk about it sooner?
I didn't know until a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the second floor closet to look for something, and I found that...
Shh. We're having company.
Tamsin!
That's Oliver.
Perfect. Meet him in the hall and don't tell him what happened.
Don't?
Go ahead and do as I say.
All right, Inspector.
And leave that door open. I want to hear everything.
Oliver?
Hey, Julie, I'm just going upstairs. Where's Tamsin?
Oh, she's indisposed.
Indisposed? I just don't understand that woman. An hour ago, she wanted to fly to Mexico tonight.
Mexico? What are you talking about?
I rushed down to my office to get these papers. I thought I'd combine pleasure with business. And now... is she upstairs?
No, Mr. Galt.
What?
She's waiting for you in the living room.
Inspector McKee.
Would you like to see her? Of course you would. Now, come on. After you've had a good look, we'll take a trip downtown to police headquarters, and you too, Miss Shannon.
If you like.
I like. And while we're driving, we'll pick up Mr. DeMora and give him a lift, too.
Santos? But why?
Your alibi, Miss Shannon. And to you, Mr. Galt, a mathematical problem. The outside angle of a triangle.
Excuse me, Inspector.
What is it, Cassidy?
I just got the report on this candle holder. No fingerprints. It was wiped clean.
All right. Stay here with Smith. I'm going into the next room to pin down a murderer.
Inspector, I'd appreciate a drink if you have one.
Great, great. Give him one, Cassidy, from that water cooler.
No, not that. I need something.
Well, Inspector McKee, are you ready for us?
For one of you, Miss Shannon, an escaped convict by the name of John Ravillo. Matter, you struck down? What about it, Mr. DeMora? Would you like to enlighten me?
I have never heard of the gentleman.
Hmm. How about you, Mr. Galt?
I don't know him. I don't recall ever having met him.
Well, then suppose I give you people an assist. Here's an ink pad. We'll take some fingerprints. Who'll be the first volunteer? You, Mr. Galt?
Well?
All right. I'm John Ravillo.
Oliver.
But I didn't commit murder. You yourself told me that Tamsin was smothered.
But you made it possible by cracking his skull.
I had no choice. We quarreled. She flew into a temper and picked up a knife.
You can do better than that. But first, what about Gilbert Shannon?
I thought he was blackmailing me. He was the only one who knew my real identity. I went to his apartment this afternoon for a showdown.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell you that because, well, because Gilbert was already dead when I found him. I was afraid. My criminal record, you know.
I know. But I also know that Shannon was not blackmailing you.
What?
Just a minute. Come in here.
When the law beckons.
And put your hat on.
Spoken like an old friend.
That's the man. I paid him the money.
Paid? You paid me?
All right, Smith, you can relax.
But I told you, Inspector, I was the bait the spider used to lure the fly in. When I saw them today in church, sitting side by side like Damon and Phineas, I...
Inspector McKee.
Huh? What is it, Mr. DeMora?
Could I have a glass of water, please?
Sure. But first, give me what you have in your hand.
You have no right to...
We'll talk about that some other time. Pills, huh? Poison. Sit down, Mr. DeMora. It's your turn to talk now about a double murder, and no double talk, if you know what I mean.
I just can't believe it. Santos DeMora, of all people.
Your father's oldest friend. Know thine enemies, but beware of thy friends.
And Oliver, an escaped convict. Well, I knew that Dad had met Oliver in San Diego.
He didn't meet him, Miss Shannon. He helped put him in jail. Your father was one of those energetic newspaper reporters who liked to play detective, too.
But Dad married Oliver's sister.
Yes, one of those things you never understand. Got the whole story from Smith. He was Gilbert Shannon's editor.
Then he knew.
Yes, but liquor and hard luck put a cloud on his mind. So when he met Oliver Gault after 20 years, he didn't recognize him as John Ravillo.
And he collected the blackmail money and turned it over to Santos DeMora.
For a whiskey pittance. Smith had to have whiskey.
Inspector, how did Santos find out about Oliver?
DeMora told me he got it from your father during a moment of whiskey weakness.
But why did he kill him?
For protection. Your father was the only one who knew Oliver's past. But DeMora was blackmailing him.
But why did he kill Tamsin?
Oh, to frame you, my dear, for both murders.
What?
You quarreled with Tamsin in a restaurant. DeMora was present.
He told you about that, too?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's very clever, I must say.
Mm.
How did he get into the house? I left him at the front door.
He unlatched it while you were saying goodnight.
Oh. Well, that explains everything.
Just enough.
Calling Inspector McKee. Calling Inspector McKee.
Oh, what now? Hmm? Another murder? What is it?
Excuse me, sir. This is Cassidy.
Mm.
There's a question that's preying on my mind, and if you'd be good enough to answer it...
Sure, sure. Anything to go home and go to bed.
Well, sir, it's about them telephone calls that Smith made to your office about their murders. Why did he do it?
An old newspaper man and a lunatic. He couldn't resist a scoop.
But how could he know about them, Inspector?
Very simple, Cassidy. He was in the right place at the wrong time.
Yes, but I...
Good night. Good night, Cassidy. Stop worrying about trifles. The case is closed.
And so closes tonight's Crime Club book, Mr. Smith's Hat, based on a story by Helen Riley. Stedman Coles did the radio adaptation. Roger Bauer produced and directed. Inspector McKee was played by Raymond Edward Johnson and Julie by Elaine Kent. The cast included William Podmore, Eleanor Phelps, Paul Hammond, Sherling Oliver, and Barry Thompson. Oh, I beg your pardon. Hello? I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Yes, this is the Crime Club. I'm the librarian. And by the way, the next time you sit down to enjoy a good show, think of the 1.5 million men who are trying to win the peace throughout the world. And yes, think of the 199,000 who helped win the war and are still in the hospitals. They like a good show, too. So keep them going with good USO entertainment. They still need USO, and USO is you.
This program came from New York. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
I'm
I'm looking for jeans that really fit.
Try Lee.
You bet I will. Fit like a glove.
Mike, all you have to do is look for the patch.
Lee Jeans, the brand that fits.
Next up is an episode of The Black Mass for September the 30th of 1969, the death of Halpin Frazier. The Black Mass was a horror fantasy radio drama produced by Eric Bannerfield for Berkeley, California radio station. The program also found an audience at station KPFA in Los Angeles, but never developed a network affiliation or any real syndication. And it's unfortunate that the show never found a regular time slot, airing on a quite irregular schedule from 1963 to 1969. I don't know about you, but I do miss the anthology format on television. The sort of dramas that are done today almost exclusively, relying on a returning cast and a stable of writers, leaves little room for the adaptation of the classics of literature. Not that that always works out great, but I think in this case it does. This week it's a story by Ambrose Bierce that opens up as two men, both policemen, both manhunters, in the pursuit of their line of work, walk a lonely road near Calistoga, California, in pursuit of a murderer, when they come across the corpse of a young man. Suddenly the point of view changes to that of the dead man, who tells us how he came to be so very dead.
Tonight, we present The Death of Halpin Frazer, adapted from the story by Ambrose Bierce.
One dark night in midsummer, a man, waking from a dreamless sleep in a forest, lifted his head from the earth and stared a few moments into the black. He said nothing more, for he was dead. The man was Halpin Frazer, and his body was discovered the following morning by Sam Holker, the deputy sheriff from Napa, and Jim Jarrelson, the detective from San Francisco. The two men left the town of St. Helena at the first glimmer of dawn and walked along the road northward up the valley toward Calistoga. They carried guns on their shoulders. Their business was manhunting.
How far is it?
No, only a little ways yet. There's a turn ahead, and it's just beyond that.
Don't see how we'll see anything when we get there. It's fog.
It'll thin out and blow off around noon, I expect. Then we'll wait around until he shows.
Till he shows?
Oh, he'll show all right. I've seen him three times.
You say he's been hanging around the graveyard?
Yeah. Where they buried his wife. Now, she was the weirdie. Ooh. Maybe you can't blame him for what he did to her. Then he sure had a lot of practice before her. Yeah, she was a widow when he met her, in fact. Came to California to look up some relative. Then you know all about that.
Mm.
Strange people. Well, now, here we are. Over here. You can see the graveyard's not kept up, not used anymore. Weeds all grown over the stones. Look out, you don't trip on them over there.
What about Branscombe? Shouldn't we watch out if he's around?
Oh, no. He don't show up till dark. I thought I'd show you the ground, and we could make some sort of plan for later. A grave is over here. He'll come by it like I saw him before. Over here under this spruce. You know, it's still a mystery to me why... He there now.
What?
He there now. Look at this.
What is it? Well, is it Branscombe?
No, isn't him. Don't know who it is.
The body lay upon its back, the legs wide apart. One arm was thrust upward, the other outward. But the latter was bent acutely, and the hand was near the throat. Both hands were tightly clenched. The whole attitude was that of desperate but ineffectual resistance to... what?
There's a shotgun over there. A game bag with birds in it. He's out game hunting.
Looks like he put up a fight, too.
Yeah.
Oak shoots all bent over. Somebody bigger than him, it looks. See the knee marks in the earth beside his hips?
Yeah.
Strangled, all right. Look at the face.
Well, Miss Branscombe did it, sure enough. Sure enough.
I have been all day in the hills west of the Napa Valley, looking for such small game as was in season. Late in the afternoon, it had come on to be cloudy, and the absence of trails had so impeded me that I was overtaken by night, unable in the darkness to penetrate the thickets. I had lain down near the roots of a large tree and fallen into a sleep, dreamless until I heard the name pronounced, I couldn't imagine why, from my own throat. Then I lay down and went to sleep, but this time no longer dreamless. I thought I was walking along a dusty road that showed white in the gathering darkness of a summer night. Why or where I traveled, I did not know, though it all seemed simple and natural as is the way in dreams. A side road left off, the appearance having been long abandoned because it seemed it led to something evil. Yet I turned into it without hesitation, impelled by some imperious necessity. As I pressed forward, I became conscious that my way was haunted by invisible existences. From among the trees on either side, I caught broken and incoherent whispers. Whispers in a strange tongue, which yet I partly understood. They seemed to me fragmentary utterances of a monstrous conspiracy against my body and my soul. A shallow pool in an old wheel rut caught my eye with a crimson gleam. I stooped and plunged my hand into it. It stained my fingers. It was blood. It was blood. Blood was everywhere about me. The weed showed it in blots and splashes on their leaves. The defile in the trunks of the trees were broad maculations of crimson. And blood dripped like dew from their foliage. All this I observed with a terror and an expectation. It seemed to be all in expiation of some crime. I was aware of my guilt, but I couldn't remember the crime. I tried to search it out by tracing my life backward to discover the moment of sin. Scenes and incidents came crowding, one picture effacing in confusion another, but nowhere could I catch a glimpse of the crime. I will not submit unheard. I will not submit unheard. There may be powers that are not malignant traveling this accursed road. I shall leave them a record. I shall leave them a record and an appeal. I shall relate the wrongs, the persecutions that I endure. I'm a helpless mortal and a penitent. I found a memorandum in my pocket, but no pencil. No pencil. I broke a twig from a bush and dipped it into a pool of blood. And I began to write. I wrote rapidly. I wrote my appeal. Oh, I don't know where the words came from, but I wrote. I had hardly touched the paper with the twig when I heard her. At first from some measureless distance away. Soulless. Heartless. A curse. A strange sensation began to take possession of my body and my mind. Some overpowering presence. A malevolence approaching me. I could not tell from what direction, from everywhere. She was everywhere about me. I had to complete my record, my appeal. I wrote with terrible rapidity. The twig rilling blood without renewal. My appeal. In the middle of a sentence, I could not move my hands. My arms fell to my sides. The paper to the earth. I was thrown about. I looked up. Staring into a face. Sharply drawn face. Blank, dead eyes. Standing white and silent in the garments of the grave. Kathy? Mother?
Halpin was the youngest. He was more delicate than the rest, and perhaps a trifle spoiled. His father had little time for him. His father was what no Southern man is not, a politician, It took a good deal of his time, and I suppose it saved us from the war. But then later, other children were at school, and I had helped him all to myself. I was very happy. We were both very happy. His father wanted him to study law. Oh, my law. Halpin was a dreamer, a romantic boy. I knew from the very beginning that he could be a poet. Well, it was in his blood. And he was the living image and character of his maternal grandfather, the late and great Myron Bain. That was my father, the famous poet, you know. He died just before Halpin was born, so they never knew each other. But I used to think that Halpin was the very incarnation, the very living image. It's true, you know, that before Halpin was born, Myron was all I had. Well, that was really how it was. My husband was in politics, you know, and the children came and went with him all so fast. And it's true, I can hardly remember one of them now. Sometimes I think there was only Halpin after all. And before him, Myron Bain. Oh, Myron, we always believed we'd be together again afterwards. But being alive was all we had, after all, wasn't it? You see, my father and I were very close. I was his inspiration. I was all he had. The only one he ever really loved. We had a perfect sympathy that the world would never have understood. So we had to take care. We had to protect our beautiful weakness, our guilt. Then suddenly he died, and I waited in all this dark world until Halpin was born. His father wanted him to study law. Oh, my. The Tennessee Frasers were a practical folk, having a contempt for any quality unfitting a man for the wholesome vocation of politics. Well, Halpin was going to disappoint them, and they could see it from the first. And what they said about him only showed their ignorance. They said he wasn't a very bright and he was a crazy like his grandfather, Myron Bain. Oh, my. Sometimes you just have to shut the whole world out, don't you? So I expect his mother spoiled him a little. You can't go blaming her for that, can you? How happy we were, Halpin and I. I was still young, you know, they'd say. Halpin and his beautiful mother. Of course, from his early childhood, Halpin called me Kathy. Halpin and Kathy. No one would have known to look. They were jealous. Yes, they were of us, as our attachment became yearly stronger, more tender. By the time he was 25, Halpin was the most beautiful of God's creatures on this earth. I must say, he didn't turn out to be much of a poet by then. But I knew that it might just burst out of him at any moment. He had it all in him, of course. All waiting. I tried to help him a little with his writing and reading. He was a little slow at first. But he was a dreamer, a romantic dreamer. You know, the two of us were almost inseparable. And by strangers observing our manner, we weren't infrequently taken for lovers. Oh, my. In all their wild days, they'd never believed how right they were. And we laughed at them, Halpin. We laughed at them, at their outrage and envy. We knew they envied us. That element in all the relations of life, strengthening, softening, and beautifying. Yes, beautifying. Even those of consanguinity. Oh, Halpin, do you remember? Do you remember even a single moment? Well, then there was that day you left me. Halpin had taken a job with a local lumber company. Oh, he wanted to do something. Didn't want to be so dependent on me, I suppose. And this friend of his talked him into working for the Talcott and Bleecker Lumber Company. Well, he hadn't been with them a month, and then that day he came into my boudoir. I suppose I knew, Halpin, by the way you kissed me on the forehead and toyed for a minute with a lock of my hair. Had you stopped loving me already, Halpin? We can't tell, can we, when someone really stops loving.
Kathy?
Well, Halpin, I have a distinct feeling that there's something on your mind. What is it, Halpin?
Oh, Kathy, would you greatly mind if I were called away to California for a few weeks?
To California?
It's for the company, Kathy. Mr. Talcott himself asked me to do this.
California is far away. How many weeks?
Only a few, Kathy. 4. Maybe 5.
Well, Halpin, it is hardly needful for me to answer with my lips a question to which my telltale cheeks have already made reply. Evidently, I would greatly mind.
Oh, Kathy, don't feel that way. I want to do this for the company, you know.
Yes, you want to get away, Halpin. I know. Oh, my dear son. I should have known this was coming. Didn't I lie awake half the night weeping because during the other half, my and Bane, your grandfather, came to me in a dream. And standing by his portrait, young too and handsome as that, he pointed to your portrait on the same wall. And when I looked, it seemed that I could not see the features. You have been painted with a cloth over your face. A cloth such as we put on the dead. Your father has laughed at me when I've told him about my dreams. But you and I, dear, we know that such things are not for nothing. And Halpin, I saw below the edge of the cloth the marks of hands on your throat. Oh, Halpin, forgive me, but we've not been used to keep such things from each other. Perhaps you have a different interpretation of my dream, Halpin. Perhaps it does not mean that you will go to California. Or maybe you'll take me with you.
That's such a strange dream, Kathy. You dreamed all that before. Didn't tell me.
Well, now you know, Halpin. I remember hearing that there are medicinal springs in California. Places where one recovers from rheumatism and neuralgia. Well, now, that might do me some good. My fingers have grown so stiff lately. You see, Halpin? So stiff, especially in the morning. I'm almost sure they have been giving me great pain while I slept. Like they was grasping something and just couldn't let go.
Like a throat, Kathy. Like a throat when you hold them like that.
Oh, but that's only in a dream, Halpin. And we don't want to mistake a dream for real life.
No, Kathy. No. We don't ever want to take a chance of mistaking a dream that way.
Was the last thing you ever said to me, Halpin. Seems I remember it as. You were gone next morning. Couldn't see you for dust. Oh, Halpin. At first I thought it was in a dream you left me, and I couldn't wake out of it, hard as I tried. My poor hands never straightened out.
They try to find you in all their emptiness. You never roamed. You just vanished like you never was. Oh, my. I came all the way to California looking for you. A long while in San Francisco, someone said you'd gone to sea. So I watched the ships and the sailors. I thought each one was you, Halpin. I may believe they were because I wanted to wake up out of my dream. Then a very mean man indeed, took me up here to the mountains. And we lived a while, torturing each other. I hid all his stolen money in the graveyard. Still looking for it, I suppose. Oh, he was very mean to me, Halpin. He had a little knife, which he kept sharp as a razor.
Kathy.
Look, Halpin.
Kathy.
Look at me. See what he did? He said he wanted to find the spot that hurt the most. Nothing hurt, Halpin. Nothing hurt.
Kathy.
Nothing hurt anywhere. Only the memory. And he couldn't find the right spot for that.
See?
But he got very close one dark night. See, Halpin? My delicate white throat. See how he cut with his razor knife from this ear to that ear. It never stopped bleeding, Halpin. Oh, you'd never believe how much blood could be stored up in one soulless body. See it, Halpin? Keeps me strong enough to come to you. And bring these aching hands to your own warm, dear throat.
Kathy, no.
See me, Halpin?
Kathy.
No. See what's gone out of me.
No, Kathy. Get away. Kathy.
Oh, my.
Kathy, no.
Oh, please. Oh, no. Oh, love. Gone out of me. I am your dream, Halpin. There is no appeal for you, Halpin. No.
To Jarrelson and Hulker, the nature of the struggle was made clear by a glance. The face and throat were purple, almost black. The shoulders lay upon a low mound, and the head was turned back at an angle otherwise impossible. From the froth filling the open mouth, the tongue protruded, black and swollen. The throat showed terrible contusions, not mere finger marks, but bruises and lacerations wrought by two strong hands that must have buried themselves in the yielding flesh, maintaining their terrible grasp until long after death.
The work of a maniac, all right. Branscombe LaRue.
Look here. Looks like he was writing something in a memorandum pad. Yeah. Pretty scrawly. Well, I guess under the circumstances. Can you make it out?
Let's see. It's poetry, looks like. The air was stagnant all. Silence was a living thing that breathed among trees. With blood, the trees were all adrip.
Sounds like Bane.
Bane? Who's Bane?
Myron Bane. Poet half a century ago. Now, why would this poor fellow want to be copying down that dismal stuff?
Dismal, all right. Well, in a way, I guess it figures.
We got a break. But we'll be back real soon with some science fiction. I hope you like science fiction. I sure do. Mind Webs is up next. It was a program of science fiction stories that ran on radio station WHL in Madison, Wisconsin from 1976 until 1984. The programs are actually more like audio books than audio drama. Really, just about someplace in between. The producers of the show took some of the very best science fiction short stories and gave them a dramatic reading, with multiple performers taking the parts of various characters. These performances are rounded off with the addition of good atmospheric music and some excellent sound effects. Tonight's episode is an absolute classic, a story from the writer Judith Merrill, That Only a Mother, which originally was published in John Campbell's Astounding Magazine for June of 1948. If this wasn't the first time that a woman took center stage in a science fiction story, to deal with a woman's perspective, addressing issues of childbirth and parenthood for the boys who read these magazines, then it had to be damn near. There were a few other women writing science fiction in the late 40s, but only a few.
Welcome to a half hour of Mind Webs, short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. Carol Cowan joins us on Mind Webs tonight to read Judith Merrill's story, That Only a Mother, a tale that first appeared in Astounding Magazine in 1948, and is reprinted by Pamela Sargent in her collection Women of Wonder, Science Fiction Stories by Women About Women. The story is about a mother, a child, and nuclear weaponry. Judith Merrill's That Only a Mother.
Now you are at the world's largest airfield on Tinian in the Marianas. The voice you hear is that of Chaplain William Downey, who stood amongst the target charts, the escape kits, and the stale coffee and said a prayer for the Enola Gay and civilization.
We pray thee that the end of the war may come soon and that once more we may know peace on earth. May the men who fly this night be kept safe in thy care, and may they be returned safely to us. We shall go forward, trusting in thee, knowing that we are in thy care now and forever. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
The bomb run lasted 4 minutes. The bomb went away at 9:15. My God, was the only entry in the co-pilot's diary. 78,150 people died at Hiroshima.
Margaret reached over to the other side of the bed where Hank should have been. Her hand patted the empty pillow, and then she came altogether awake, wondering that the old habit should remain after so many months. She tried to curl up, cat-style, to hoard her own warmth, found she couldn't do it anymore, and climbed out of bed with a pleased awareness of her increasingly clumsy bulkiness. Morning motions were automatic. On the way through the kitchenette, she pressed the button that would start breakfast cooking. The doctor had said to eat as much breakfast as she could, and tore the paper out of the facsimile machine. She folded the long sheet carefully to the national news section and propped it on the bathroom shelf to scan while she brushed her teeth. No accidents, no direct hits, at least none that had been officially released for publication. Now, Maggie, don't get started on that. No accidents, no hits. Take the nice newspaper's word for it. The three clear chimes from the kitchen announced that breakfast was ready. She set a bright napkin and cheerful colored dishes on the table in a futile attempt to appeal to a faulty morning appetite. Then, when there was nothing more to prepare, she went for the mail, allowing herself the full pleasure of prolonged anticipation because today there would surely be a letter. There was. There were. Two bills and a worried note from her mother, which read, "Darling, why didn't you write and tell me sooner? I'm thrilled, of course, but... Well, one hates to mention these things, but are you certain the doctor was right? Hank's been around all that uranium and thorium or whatever it is all these years, and I know you say he's a designer, not a technician, and doesn't get near anything that might be dangerous, but... Well, you know he used to, back at Oak Ridge. Don't you think... Oh, well, of course, I'm just being a foolish old woman, and I don't want to get you upset. You know much more about it than I do, and I'm sure your doctor was right. He should know." Margaret made a face over the excellent coffee and caught herself refolding the paper to the medical news. "Stop it, Maggie. Stop it. The radiologist said Hank's job couldn't have exposed him. And the bombed area that we drove past... No, no, now stop it now. Read the social notes or the recipes, Maggie girl." A well-known geneticist in the medical news said that it was possible to tell with absolute certainty at 5 months whether the child would be normal, or at least whether the mutation was likely to produce anything freakish. The worst cases, at any rate, could be prevented. Minor mutations, of course, displacements in facial features or changes in brain structure could not be detected. And there had been some cases recently of normal embryos with atrophied limbs that did not develop beyond the 7th or 8th month. But, the doctor concluded cheerfully, the worst cases could now be predicted and prevented. Predicted and prevented. We predicted it, didn't we? Hank and the others, they predicted it. But we didn't prevent it. We could have stopped it, but we didn't. And now... Margaret decided against breakfast. Coffee had been enough for her in the morning for 10 years. It would have to do for today. She buttoned herself into interminable folds of material that the sales girl had assured her was the only comfortable thing to wear during the last few months. And with a surge of pure pleasure, the letter the newspaper forgotten, she realized that she was on the next to the last button. It wouldn't be long now. The city in the early morning had always been a special kind of excitement for her. Last night it had rained and the sidewalks were still damp gray instead of dusty. The air smelled the fresher to a city-bred woman for the occasional pungency of acrid factory smoke. She walked the 6 blocks to work, watching the lights go out in the all-night hamburger joints where the plate glass walls were already catching the sun, and the lights go on in the dim interiors of cigar stores and dry-cleaning establishments. The office was in a new government building. In the rollovator on the way up, she felt, as always, like a Frankfurter roll in the ascending half of an old-style rotary toasting machine. She abandoned the air foam cushioning gratefully at the 14th floor and settled down behind her desk at the rear of a long row of identical desks. Each morning, the pile of papers that greeted her was a little higher. These were, as everyone knew, the decisive months. The war might be won or lost on these calculations as well as many others. The manpower office had switched her here when her old expediter's job had got to be too strenuous. The computer was easy to operate, and the work was absorbing, if not as exciting as the old job. But you didn't just stop working these days. Everyone who could do anything at all was needed. Vaguely, she remembered the interview with the psychologist. "I'm probably the unstable type. Wonder what sort of neurosis I'd get sitting home reading that sensational paper." And she plunged into work without pursuing the thought. February 18th. "Hank, darling... Just a note. From the hospital, no less. I had a dizzy spell at work, and the doctor took it to heart. Blessed if I know what I'll do with myself lying in bed for weeks, just waiting. But Dr. Boyer seemed to think it may not be too long. There are too many newspapers around here. More infanticides all the time. And they can't seem to get a jury to convict any of them. It's the fathers who do it. Lucky thing you're not around, just in case..." Oh, darling, that wasn't a very funny joke, was it? Write as often as you can, will you? I have too much time to think. But there really isn't anything wrong and nothing to worry about. Write often and remember, I love you, Maggie.
Special Service Telegram, February 21st, 1992. From Tech Lieutenant H. Marvell to Mrs. H. Marvell, Women's Hospital, New York City. Had Doctors Graham, stop. Will arrive 4:10, stop. Short leave, stop. You did it, Maggie, stop. Love, Hank.
February 25th. Hank, dear. Oh, so you didn't see her either. You'd think a place this size would at least have visiplates on the incubators so that fathers could get a look, even if the poor, benighted mamas can't. They tell me I won't see her for another week, or maybe more. But, of course, Mother always warned me that if I didn't slow my pace, I'd probably even have my babies too fast. Why is she always right? Did you meet that battle axe of a nurse they put on here? I imagine they save her for people who've already had theirs and don't let her get too near the perspectives. But a woman like that simply shouldn't be allowed in a maternity ward. She's obsessed with mutations. Can't seem to talk about anything else. Oh, well, ours is all right. Even if it was in an unholy hurry. I'm tired. They warned me not to sit up too soon, but I had to write to you. All my love, darling, Maggie. February 29th. Darling, I finally got to see her. It's all true what they say about new babies and the face that only a mother could love. But it's all there, darling. Eyes, ears, and noses. No, only one. All in the right places. Oh, we're so lucky, Hank. I'm afraid I've been a rambunctious patient. I kept telling that hatchet-faced female with the mutation mania that I wanted to see the baby. Finally, the doctor came in to explain everything to me and talked a lot of nonsense, most of which I'm sure no one could have understood any more than I did. The only thing I got out of it was that she didn't actually have to stay in the incubator. They just thought it was a little wiser. I think I got a little hysterical at that point. I guess I was more worried than I was willing to admit, but I threw a small fit about it. The whole business wound up with one of those hushed medical conferences outside the door, and finally the woman in white said, "Well, we might as well. Maybe it'll work out better that way." I'd heard about the way doctors and nurses in these places develop a god complex, and believe me, it is as true figuratively as it is literally that a mother hasn't got a leg to stand on around here. I am awfully weak still. I'll write again soon. Love, Maggie. Mark 8. Dearest Hank. Well, the nurse was wrong if she told you that. She's an idiot anyhow. It's a girl. It's easier to tell with babies than with cats, and I know. How about Henrietta? I'm home again, and busier than a Betatron. They got everything mixed up at the hospital, and I had to teach myself how to bathe her and do just about everything else. She's getting prettier, too. When can you get a leave? A real leave? Love, Maggie. May 26th. Hank, dear, you should see her now, and you shall. I'm sending along a reel of color movie. My mother sent her those nighties with drawstrings all over. I put one on, and right now she looks like a snow-white potato sack with that beautiful, beautiful flower face blooming on top. Is that me talking? Am I a doting mother? Oh, but wait till you see her. July 10th. Believe it or not as you like, but your daughter can talk, and I don't mean baby talk. Alice discovered it. She's a dental assistant in the wax, you know. And when she heard the baby giving out what I thought was a string of gibberish, she said that the kid knew words and sentences, but couldn't say them clearly because she has no teeth yet. I'm taking her to a speech specialist. September 13. We have a prodigy for real. Now that all her front teeth are in, her speech is perfectly clear, and a new talent now, she can sing. I mean, she can really carry a tune at 7 months. Darling, my world would be perfect if you could only get home. November 19. At last. The little goon was so busy being clever, it took her all this time to learn to crawl. The doctor says development in these cases is always erratic.
Special Service Telegram, December 1st, 1992, from Tech Lieutenant H. Marvell. To Mrs. H. Marvell, apartment K-17, 504 East 19th Street, New York, New York. Week's leave starts tomorrow. Stop. We'll arrive airport 10:05. Stop. Don't meet me. Stop. Love, love, love. Hank.
Margaret let the water run out of the bassinet until only a few inches were left, and then she loosed her hold on the wriggling baby. I think it was better when you were a retarded young woman, she informed her daughter happily. You can't crawl in a bassinet, you know.
Then why can't I go in the bathtub?
Margaret was used to her child's volubility by now, but every now and then it caught her unawares. She swooped the resistant mass of pink flesh into a towel and began to rub. Because you're too little and your head is very soft and bathtubs are very hard.
Oh, then when can I go in the bathtub?
When the outside of your head is as hard as the inside, brainchild. She reached toward a pile of fresh clothing. I cannot understand, she added, pinning a square of cloth through the nightgown, why a child of your intelligence can't learn to keep a diaper on the way other babies do. They've been used for centuries, you know, with perfectly satisfactory results. The child disdained to reply. She'd heard it too often. She waited patiently until she'd been tucked clean and sweet-smelling into a white-painted crib. Then she favored her mother with a smile that inevitably made Margaret think of the first golden edge of the sun bursting into a rosy pre-dawn. She remembered Hank's reaction to the color pictures of his beautiful daughter, and with a thought realized how late it was. Go to sleep, puss, please. When you wake up, you know, your daddy will be here.
Why?
Asked the 4-year-old mind, waging a losing battle to keep a 10-month-old body awake. Margaret went into the kitchenette and set the timer for the roast. She examined the table and got her new clothes out of the closet. New dress, new shoes, new slip, new everything bought weeks before and saved for the day Hank's telegram came. She stopped to pull a paper from the facsimile and with clothes and news went into the bathroom and lowered herself gingerly into a steaming luxury of a scented tub. She glanced through the paper with indifferent interest. Today, at least, there was no need to read the national news. There was an article by a geneticist, the same geneticist. Mutations, he said, were increasing disproportionately. It was too soon for recessives. Even the first mutants were not old enough yet to breed. But my baby's all right. Apparently, there was some degree of free radiation from atomic explosions causing the trouble. My baby's fine. Precocious, but normal. If more attention had been paid to the first Japanese mutations, he said. There was that little notice in the paper in the spring of 85. That was when Hank quit at Oak Ridge. Only 2 or 3 of those guilty of infanticide are being caught and punished in Japan today. But my baby's all right. She was dressed, combed, and ready to the last light blush on her lip paste when the door chime sounded. She dashed for the door and heard for the first time in 18 months the almost forgotten sound of a key turning in the lock before the chime had quite died away. Hank.
Maggie.
And then there was nothing to say. So many days, so many months, so small news piling up, so many things to tell him, and now she just stood there. She traced the features with the finger of memory. The same high-bridged nose, wide-set eyes, fine feathery brows, the same long jaw, the hair a little further back now on the high forehead, the same tilted curve of his mouth. Pale? Of course, he'd been underground all this time. And strange. Stranger because of lost familiarity than any newcomer's face could be. She had time to think all that before his hand reached out to touch her and spanned the gap of 18 months. Now again there was nothing to say because there was no need. They were together, and for the moment, that was enough.
Where's the baby?
Sleeping. She'll be up any minute. No urgency. Their voices were casual, as though it were a daily exchange, as though war and separation did not exist. Margaret picked up the coat he'd thrown on the chair near the door and hung it carefully in the closet. She went to check the roast, leaving him to wander through the rooms by himself, remembering and coming back. She found him finally, standing over the baby's crib. She couldn't see his face, but she had no need to. Hank, I think we can wake her just this once. Margaret pulled the covers down and lifted the white bundle from the bed, sleepy lids pulled back heavily from smoky brown eyes.
Hello.
Hank's voice was tentative.
Hello.
The baby's assurance was more pronounced. He'd heard it, of course, but that wasn't the same as hearing it. He turned eagerly to Margaret.
Maggie, she really can?
Of course she can, darling. But what's more important, she can even do nice normal things like other babies do, even stupid ones. Come on, watch her crawl. and Margaret set the baby on the big bed. And for a moment, young Henrietta lay and eyed her parents dubiously.
Cry?
Well, that's the idea, honey. Your daddy's new around here, you know. Well, he wants to see you show off.
Then put me in my tummy.
Oh, of course. And Margaret obligingly rolled the baby over.
Maggie, what's the matter? I thought they, you know, turned over first.
This baby, Hank, darling, this baby does things when she wants to. This baby's father watched with softening eyes while the head advanced and the body hunched up, propelling itself across the bed.
Why, the little rascal. She looks like one of those potato sack racers they used to have on picnics, Maggie. And she's got her arms pulled out of the sleeves already.
Oh, here, I'll do it, darling.
Well, don't be silly, Maggie. This may be your first baby, but, you know, I had five kid brothers.
And he reached with his hand for the string that closed one sleeve. He opened the sleeve bow and groped for an arm.
The way you wriggle, anyone might think you're a worm using your tummy to crawl on instead of your hands and feet.
And his hand touched a moving knob of flesh at the shoulder. Margaret stood and watched, smiling. Hank, darling, wait till you hear her sing. His right hand traveled down from the shoulder to where he thought an arm would be, traveled down and straight down over firm small muscles that writhed in an attempt to move against the pressure of his hand. He let his fingers drift up again to the shoulder, and with infinite care, he opened the knot at the bottom of the nightgown. His wife was standing by the bed saying, "Hank, she can do jingle bells and several other things." His left hand felt along the soft, knitted fabric of the gown, up toward the diaper that folded flat and smooth across the bottom end of his child. No wrinkles. No kicking. No...
Maggie?
He tried to pull his hands from the neat fold in the diaper, from the wriggling body.
Maggie...
His voice went dry, words came hard, low, and grating. He spoke very, very slowly, thinking the sound of each word to make himself say it. His head was spinning, but he had to know before he let it go.
Maggie, why didn't you tell me?
Tell you what, darling? Margaret's poise was the immemorial patience of woman confronted with man's childish impetuosity.
Her sudden laugh sounded fantastically easy and natural in that room. It was all clear to her now.
Oh, Hank, I'm sorry. Is she wet? I didn't know.
She didn't know. My hands, beyond control, ran up and down the soft-skinned baby body, the sinuous, limbless body. Oh, God, dear God. My head shook, muscles contracted in a bitter spasm of hysteria. My fingers tightened on the child. Oh, God, she didn't know. A Mother, a story that appeared in Pamela Sargent's collection, Women of Wonder. Science fiction stories by women, about women. This is Michael Hansen speaking. Technical production by Steve Gordon. MindWebs is produced at WHA in Madison, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension.
One Summer Night by Ambrose Bierce. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to learn how to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Paul Curran in the hills of northern England. One Summer Night by Ambrose Bierce. The fact that Henry Armstrong was buried did not seem to prove that he was dead. He had always been a hard man to convince. That he was really buried, the testimony of his senses compelled him to admit. His posture, flat upon his back, with his hands crossed on his stomach and tied with something that he easily broke without profitably altering the situation, the strict confinement of his entire person, the black darkness and profound silence, made a body of evidence impossible to controvert, and he accepted it without cavil. But dead? No. He was only very, very ill. He had, withal, the invalid's apathy, and did not greatly concern himself about the uncommon fate that had been allotted to him. No philosopher was he, just a plain, commonplace person, gifted, for the time being, with a pathological indifference. The organ that he feared consequences with was torpid. So, with no particular apprehension for his immediate future, he fell asleep, and all was peace with Henry Armstrong. But something was going on overhead. It was a dark summer night, shot through with infrequent shimmers of lightning, silently firing a cloud lying low in the west and portending a storm. There, brief, stammering illuminations brought out with ghastly distinctness the monuments and headstones of the cemetery and seemed to set them dancing. It was not a night in which any credible witness was likely to be straying about a cemetery, so the three men who were there, digging into the grave of Henry Armstrong, felt reasonably secure. Two of them were young students from a medical college a few miles away. The third was a gigantic man known as Jess. For many years, Jess had been employed about the cemetery as a man of all work, and it was his favourite pleasantry that he knew every soul in the place. From the nature of what he was now doing, it was inferable that the place was not so populous as its register may have shown it to be. Outside the wall, at the part of the grounds farthest from the public road, were a horse and a light wagon, waiting. The work of excavation was not difficult. The earth with which the grave had been loosely filled a few hours before offered little resistance and was soon thrown out. Removal of the casket from its box was less easy, but it was taken out, for it was a prerequisite of Jess, who carefully unscrewed the cover and laid it aside, exposing the body in black trousers and white shirt. At that instant, the air sprang to flame, a crackling shock of thunder stunned the world, and Henry Armstrong tranquilly sat up. With inarticulate cries, the men fled in terror, each in a different direction, for nothing on earth could two of them have been persuaded to return. But Jess was of another breed. In the grey of the morning, the two students, pallid and haggard from anxiety, and with the terror of their adventure still beating tumultuously in their blood, met at the college. "You saw it," cried one. "God, yes! What are we to do?" They went around to the rear of the building, where they saw a horse attached to a light wagon, hitched to a gatepost near the door of the dissecting room. Mechanically, they entered the room. On a bench, in the obscurity, sat Jess. He rose, grinning, all eyes and teeth. "I'm waiting for my pay," he said. Stretched naked, on a long table lay the body of Henry Armstrong, the head defiled with blood and clay, from a blow with a spade. One Summer Night by Ambrose Bierce.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
One, two, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock. 5, 7, 6, 9, 8 o'clock rock. 9, 13, 14, 17, or, just a minute. Or to hell with it.
I don't really think that murder at midnight could be categorized as a guilty pleasure for me. As silly as it was at times, I've actually come to love it. It was produced in New York and heard over the Mutual Network, starting on September 16th of 1946. It would run until September the 8th of 1947. It was produced by the radio station WJZ and was known to occasionally reproduce scripts that had been performed on the Inter Sanctum. It was this practice that allowed the show to feature some tales of murder and macabre by some of radio's top performers without paying top dollar. Still, the show is filled with tales of death and mayhem, and not always at midnight. The show was hosted by Raymond Morgan, and maybe that's the most memorable thing. Raymond Morgan intoning,
"Midnight, the witching hour when the night is darkest, our fears the strongest, and our strength at its lowest ebb. Midnight, when the graves gape open and death strikes."
Anyway, guilty pleasure or not, this is Murder at Midnight, and this is the first episode of Murder at Midnight from September the 16th of 1946, The Dead Hand.
Murder at Midnight.
Look, wait. Come back here.
Wait, nothing. I said you were nuts, crazy. And no. No, don't.
I'm sorry, Hook. Very sorry. But I had to have it. I'm going to have it.
And once you're dead, you'll never miss it. Midnight. The witching hour when the night is darkest, our fears the strongest, and our strength at its lowest ebb. Midnight, when the graves gape open and death strikes. How? You'll learn the answer in just a minute in The Dead Hand. Murder at Midnight. Tales of terror and retribution by one of radio's best-known mystery writers, Robert Newman. Its title, The Dead Hand. The small studio cottage on Dr. Martin Trent's estate. Seated at the piano, alone in the gathering darkness, is Roger Blaine, the famous pianist, and playing as only he can play.
Hear me, Lorna. You must hear me. And you must come here now to me. I'm calling you, Lorna. Calling to you in a way you could never resist. With my music, making your heart beat faster, your breath come quicker. Lorna!
Hello, Roger. Am I disturbing you?
Always, Lorna. Just as I disturb you. As we disturbed each other since the first time we met.
Martin's out at the hospital, and I heard you playing, so...
That's not why you came, Lorna. You came because I called you. Because you promised you'd come and give me your answer.
What we talked about last night, my going away with you? Roger, I must have been mad. I don't know what got into me.
Don't you, Lorna? This is what got into you. My music. Telling you things I never could tell you in words.
Roger, stop. I can't think when you play like that. I can't leave him. He's my husband. I love him. Respect him.
Can you love a surgical instrument? Can you compare what you feel towards him with what you feel to... now, this minute?
No. No, it is different. Roger, how can we? He's your friend. It was he that brought you here, gave you the cottage.
And haven't I given him anything? Music like this. Music such as no one has ever heard before.
Roger,
Lorna, listen to me. To what I'm saying here. I love you. I need you. It was you who helped me find depths within myself I never knew existed. You've got to come away with me. You owe it to me. To yourself. To the world.
Roger,
you
please.
You know you want to. And you're going to.
Roger, no. I can't, I tell you.
You are.
All right.
Lorna.
We can talk to Martin when he gets home tonight. Tell him. I think he
No, Lorna, understand. There'll be no talking, no explaining. My car's outside and we're leaving right now. The music, my music, was still with me as we drove out through the gates, down the highway, pulsing, throbbing. Yes, I could hear it, but could Lorna? I glanced at her sitting there beside me. Happy, dearest?
What? I don't know, Roger.
You don't know? Don't you realize what this means, Lorna? I'm playing better than I ever played before, and this is only the beginning. After my New York concert, South America, then Europe.
Roger, are you sure you love me? Me as a person?
Am I sure? Oh, what do you mean, Lorna?
I know you've said you do, but whenever you've talked about it, Roger, about us, you've talked in terms of your music. Roger, are you sure that's not what you love?
Well, of course I'm sure. If I didn't have my music, if I couldn't play, I don't think I could live. But
I know.
Was you. You who lifted me to heights I never dreamed of, technically, emotionally.
Roger, stop the car, turn around, take me back.
What?
Take me back.
I don't understand.
I do, for the first time. With Martin away so much, I was lonely, flattered by your attention. And your music was like a drug, keeping me from thinking. But now I can think. And I know you don't love me, and I don't love you, so... Please, Roger, take me back.
No.
But, Roger, can't you see? This whole thing was a mistake.
It was not a mistake. And I won't take you back.
Well, I'm going back, whether you take me or not, and if you won't stop the car...
Laura, no! Let go there, Ray! Let go! That ditch, look out! We're going to... When I opened my eyes, I was in a bare white room in a hospital. Standing next to the bed, Lorna and Martin.
Hello, Roger. How are you feeling?
What? I don't know. What happened?
You were out driving with Lorna. The car got out of control and you had a smash-up. They rushed you here to the hospital and... Well, you've been here for 2 days.
Smash-up? Yes, I remember. Are you all right, Lorna?
Yes, Roger. I was shaken up. Come on. Oh,
my hand hurts. Especially the fingers. Nothing happened to her, did it, Martin? I've got a concert in a few weeks, you know.
Roger, don't stop it.
What? Why are you looking at me like that? Oh,
don't worry about it, Roger. Not now.
But I've got to know. I've got to see.
Roger, please. It's gone. My hand. My left hand. Martin, what did you do to me?
Roger, I think you know how I feel about you, about your music. You've got to believe me when I tell you there was nothing I could do about it. Nothing. It was your hand or your life.
My life? And what is my life without my music? Nothing. Worse than nothing. A living death. Why didn't you let me die?
Don't say that, Roger. We'll do anything we can. There must be something.
Something? There's just one thing. You've got to get me another hand.
We will, Roger. There have been some wonderful developments in prosthetics as a result of the war.
I don't mean an artificial hand. I mean a real hand.
What? Roger, you're mad.
No, I'm not. You took my hand and you'll get me another one.
We'll talk about it some other time.
You think I'll forget about it, don't you? Don't you? Oh, I won't. I say I'm going to have another hand, and I will have one. And what's more, you're going to help me get it, you hear? You're going to help me.
I was able to get up and around a few days later. I didn't talk to anyone if I could help it, because somehow I couldn't ever look at their faces, only their hands. Big hands and little ones, long-fingered ones and stubby ones. Yes, they each had two hands, and I to whom my piano meant more than life, had only one. Then, sitting alone one evening, I met Hawk. I looked up, and there he was, a small, slight, sharp-featured man.
Hello. Nice evening.
Yes, I suppose it is.
You mind if I sit down for a couple of minutes?
No.
I wouldn't usually bust in on anybody except... Well, I'm getting out of here tomorrow, and I feel pretty good about it.
Oh? What was wrong with you?
Bad heart. I'm going to have to take it easy from now on. It's going to make it kind of tough in some ways, but... You don't happen to have a cigarette on you, do you?
Well, yes, I do have. It's, there. Well, at least I did have. Silver cigarette case. Can't see.
Is,
fine.
This it?
What? Oh, yeah. Where did you find it?
In your pocket.
You mean you took it?
My name's Harris, Joe Harris. You usually call me the Hook. This is my racket. I ran it was until I...
You're a pickpocket.
Well, one of the best in the business. But now with my ticket going bad, I guess I'll have to lay off, except like now for a gag. You didn't mind, did you?
Mine? Certainly not. I'm very impressed. As a matter of fact, do you mind if I look at your hands?
Look at it? What for?
They're beautiful. As beautiful a pair of hands as I've ever seen. It occurs to me that you say that you don't know what you're going to do when you leave the hospital here.
Well, I just hadn't thought about it much. Why?
I've got a proposition that might possibly interest you.
No kidding. What?
Well, I'd rather not discuss it with you here and now, but I expect to be leaving here myself on Friday. If you'd like to come and see me sometime after
you
that...
You say where and when?
Well, I've been staying at a little cottage on Dr. Martin Krentz's estate. I'll probably be going back there. How about Saturday night, late, around 11:30?
Fine. Okay with me.
Then it's a date. I left him there. Hurried back to my room. I wanted to be alone. Had to be alone, for I was afraid that what was on my mind might show in my face. It certainly was a date. A date with death.
A man obsessed, half mad, and his unsuspecting victim. Will both of them still be alive to hear it when the clock strikes 12 for
murder
at Midnight. Here is Roger Blaine to continue Murder at Midnight.
I did leave the hospital on Friday, went back to the little studio cottage. By Saturday night, my arrangements were completed. They weren't very complicated. I made it clear to Lorna and Martin that I wanted to be alone, and I picked up a length of iron pipe. The pipe I hid inside the piano when I heard footsteps coming down the path. There was a knock on the door. Come in.
Hi. Not too late, am I?
No, you're not too late.
Hey, pretty nice place you got here.
Yes, it is quite nice. Sit down.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Now, what's this here proposition you want to talk to me about?
It's a very simple one. How would you like to make $10,000?
What do I have to do?
You don't have to do anything. Just sell me something. Your left hand.
What? You're nuts.
No, I'm serious. I've got the money right here, in cash.
I don't get it. I just don't understand.
Look, I'm a musician. I'm a pianist. Or I was until I lost my hand. If I can't go on playing, then life doesn't mean anything to me, my own life or anyone else's. But you, how important is your hand to you? Now, an artificial one will do almost as well. And you can live for quite a while on $10,000.
You mean you really thought I'd sell you my hand? Let you cut it off? I'm getting out of here.
Look, wait.
Wait, nothing. I said you was nuts, but I didn't really think... Oh, what are you going to do with that? No. No, don't. You can't. Some way. Somehow I'll get you for this. I swear.
I'm sorry, Hook. Very sorry. But I have to have it. I'd rather not go into what happened after that. I got rid of the body. And then I went to see Martin.
You don't look well, Roger. Anything the matter?
No, I just came to see you about your promise.
My promise?
Or your debt, whichever you choose to call it. I told you I wanted another hand, that I was going to get another hand, and that you were going to help me. Well, now you can help me.
What do you mean?
Look in here, in this package. See?
Good Lord. Where did you get this?
It might be better if you didn't ask too many questions. I'm fighting for my life, for more than my life. You took my hand away from me. Well, now you can give me this.
You mean you honestly, seriously think that I can perform an operation of this sort, do a graft, and that after I'm finished, you'll be able to use the hand?
Why not? Operations of this sort have been done, haven't they? With other parts of the body? The eye?
The cornea, not the eye. And some nerve grafting has been done. But this... Look, Roger... I know what a shock this whole thing has been to you. Know it better than you. You're not a well man.
A well man? I'm only half alive. And I'd rather be dead than go on living this way. But if I do die, I won't die alone. That's why I brought this along.
Roger!
A gun. Quick, easy, painless. If you won't do what I want, you die. And so does Lorna. Both of you, along with me.
You don't give me very much choice.
No.
All right. You win. Get me the hospital.
Even before I became fully conscious, before I opened my eyes, I knew that it had been done. That it wasn't his hand anymore, but mine.
And still, there was something wrong. I couldn't analyze what it was at first, but it was there. A feeling that something wasn't quite right. That perhaps it wasn't entirely my hand. I sat up. The hand was a mass of bandages, stiffened with splints. And inside the bandages...
Careful, Roger. Don't touch them.
Huh? Oh, Martin, I didn't see you.
I've been here with you ever since last night.
Last night? You mean I've been out that long, 24 hours?
It was very important that you keep quiet. You've been under sedation.
Oh, yes, of course. This isn't the hospital.
No, I brought you home with me, back to the house. Oh. I thought it would be best for several reasons.
Oh, that's very smart, Martin. We don't want any questions, do we? Not yet. You did do it, didn't you?
What? Yes.
I knew you would. Could. And it's going to work. It is working. I can feel it.
Please, Roger. You must be careful with that bandage. Hmm? You can't touch it, move it, disturb it in any way.
I won't, Martin. But I don't have to. I tell you, I can feel the fingers moving, even inside this. And in another week or so...
We'll see.
Yes. We'll see. Got a cigarette, Martin?
Of course, I have it right. That's funny.
Hmm? What is?
My cigarette case. It was right here in my breast pocket. I must have left it downstairs at the hospital.
It doesn't matter. I can do it. But... Martin?
Yes?
I think... Here it is. Under my pillow.
What? How did it get there?
I don't know. It must have fallen out when you bent over. But... No.
Why are you looking like that?
Because... I think I know how it did get under my pillow.
What do you mean?
When fingers learn something, a special skill, they don't forget it, ever. Mine never have. Even when I'm not thinking of what I'm doing, they go on playing by themselves. These fingers here, they haven't forgotten either. You understand?
I'm afraid I...
Forget it. I'm awfully tired all of a sudden, Martin. Would you mind?
No, Roger, I'd like you to get as much rest as possible. There's a friend of mine coming here tomorrow to see you. Another doctor.
That's fine, Martin. I'll see you in the morning. Yes, I was tired, but that wasn't why I asked Martin to go. It was because I wanted to be alone, because I had to be alone. Because I knew now what it was that I'd only sensed before. The hand. Hook's hand. Had a will of its own. It had picked Martin's pocket without my even being aware of it. I lay there alone in the darkness after Martin went, not touching the bandages, but flexing the fingers, forcing them to obey my will. I had to do that. I knew I had to do it because I suspected what might happen. And what did happen proved that I was right. I fell asleep finally. And while I was asleep, I dreamed. I dreamed I was walking down a dark, labyrinthine corridor somewhere under the earth. Then...
A little closer, Roger.
Huh?
Just a little closer.
Who's that? Who's there?
Just me. Waiting for you.
Hook!
Yeah, Hook. I said it'd get you. No, well...
Out of the darkness came a hand that clutched me by the throat, gripped it tighter. 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 I fought against it. Tried to scream. And woke up. Yes, I woke up, and my waking was more horrible than the dream, for the hand was there, gripping me by the throat, moaning, exerting every ounce of my strength and will. I fought it off and pulled it down. I lay there, bathed in a cold sweat, staring at it, feeling the fingers quivering inside the bandages. My hand or his, I was tied to it now. Tied to a thing that was seeking to destroy me.
Shaking convulsively, I leaped out of bed. I ran out into the hall and down the stairs to the living room, the piano. That was the one thing that might save me, save my reason. Seeing myself at the piano, I started to play, using only my right hand at first. But I tried to force my left hand, his hand, to join in. Then suddenly...
No, Roger.
Oh.
That won't work.
Yes.
No music.
Stop it! Stop it! Do you hear it? It's my hand now. It's mine.
No, Roger. Never.
But it is. I'm stronger than you are.
Nothing is stronger than I am. Nothing in the world. And there's no escape. Because we're one now, Roger. And wherever you go, I'll be there, too.
It's not true. It's not... What are you doing?
Just a little closer to the desk, Roger. A little closer. That paper knife.
You can't.
But I can, Roger. I told you I'd get you somehow. Some way.
Put it down. Drop.
You can't fight against me, Roger. I told you. I'm too strong.
Martha! Martha! Quick! Save the head!
Where is he, Martin?
The living room. I heard the piano and... Good Lord.
Roger!
He's dead.
But why? How? He was saying something about a hand.
He was in a completely psychotic state as a result of shock and a sense of guilt. The state psychiatrist was coming tomorrow to commit him.
Oh, Martin...
That hand he brought me, wanted me to graft on. I don't know where he got it, but I suspect that was behind the whole thing.
Behind it?
Yes.
Well, what do you mean?
You don't really think I did graft it on, do you?
Why?
He was desperate, and I had to do something to quiet him. I splinted his left wrist, wrapped it in bandages, and told him not to touch them.
But, Martin, that paper knife in his chest.
Which hand is holding it?
His right one, his good one.
Yes. And still, in a way, it's possible that the dead hand, the one he was so concerned about, did guide it.
Her eyes wide with awful comprehension, Lorna stares at her husband, then down at Roger Blaine's body as somewhere in the silent house, a clock starts chiming for murder at midnight. Remember to be with us again when death stretches out his bony hand and the clocks strike 12 for murder at midnight. With music by Charles Paul, Murder at Midnight is directed by Anton M. Leder.
Okay, that's it. That's another Night Transmissions in the can. Well, almost in the can. Oh, and before I go, I'm going to give you my email address in hopes that somebody will write me. If you're so disposed, I'm available at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. You can also drop by the website. There's a contact button there. Oh, the website, as you might expect, is www.nighttransmissions, one word, always just one word whenever you're dealing with anything on the internet and night transmissions, www.nighttransmissions.com. There, I said it. See ya.